Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, Diane Frankham from the Bristol and West England China Bureau. And Stephen Landrigan, he's a former Washington Post journalist and a neighbour between 2006 and 2008 of the Conservative MP and leadership contender, as was Rory Stewart, over in Kabul, Afghanistan. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio, one word, .co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, the Arts Centre on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show.
Hello, I'm Diane Frankham. I'm the Chief Executive of the Bristol and West of England China Bureau, to which I will refer to as China Bureau for the shortened version in the rest of this interview. The organisation has been operating for over 18 years now. It helped to facilitate the sister city relationship between Bristol and Guangzhou. We now have very strong links across the whole of Guangdong province. And Guangdong province is the size of the UK, and that is just the most southerly province of China.
It's quite close to Hong Kong, isn't it?
It butts onto the border of Hong Kong and Zhuhai and Macau. So it has a very tropical climate. It's a coastal port city, so great synergies with Bristol in that sense. Part of the maritime Silk Route. So eventually many of those goods did end up in Bristol via Circuitous route many years ago. And of course, that route, both across sea and land now, has been reactivated in recent years. So many of the products coming into the UK will follow a similar route to what they did in ancient times.
I mean, so how is the China Bureau funded?
We are funded because we are a limited company by guarantees. So we're a membership organisation. So companies and individuals across the region who have an interest in China or are doing business in China, who want to open doors in China, will become members of the organisation. And then we run numerous events as well through which we hopefully raise some money, which helps to fund the work that we do.
So you're not funded by through the Foreign Office or Chinese government or anything?
No, nothing like that at all. There's no other external funding that's available to us. We have to raise the money that we need in order to further develop the relationships. Luckily, many of our members give their services for free. We have venues that are provided for us in terms of to enable us to hold events and activities. So it's amazing what you can do on a shoestring. And of course, myself and all the officers give our time for free.
So well, just give us an idea of what your events are like. Just give us maybe one of the more recent ones.
Okay, well, the most recent one and the biggest flagship event of the year is to celebrate Chinese New Year. Events across Bristol now, because of the rise in interest across China, actually go on for 2 to 3 weeks, which is about the length of time they go on in China, because all the Chinese community groups, the student groups, have their own events. The museum has a two-day festival every year to celebrate Chinese New Year. At Bristol Museum, an art gallery at the top of Park Street. The first weekend following Chinese New Year, they have a whole cultural event and activity going on there. Our own event, we will host somewhere in the region of 220 to 240 business people across the region for a large, significant networking event and banquet where the Lord Mayor always presides, because the Lord Mayor is president of the association, whoever is holding that role each year. And the limit on numbers is simply because of finding a venue in Bristol that will take any more people than that.
I mean, isn't it a bit awkward with President Trump and his trade war with China? I imagine that that's not what most business people in the Southwest want to hear.
Well, it isn't. But luckily, that is the US, and UK-Sino relations, i.e. UK-China relations, are much more friendly and much warmer than
But the
that.
Americans are putting a... I mean,
but
aren't
they
we part of the...
To put
we're part
on
of
it.
The American empire, aren't we? I mean, that's what many
well,
people say.
Well, maybe after this last week or the last few days, many people would think so. But I think we're still independent. I think we still have strong, significant links to China. And that, if you like, the dialogue will go on between China and the US.
Ah, but will the trade? That's the problem. Anyway, what sort of business links are there then? You know, what sort of, I would imagine most of the trade is one way, is from China to here.
A lot of the trade into the city is that way, but there's also a lot of exports that are going out. So a lot of our local food and drink products are now going
Give
to
us
China.
An example. What do the Chinese want that Bristol
okay.
can produce?
Well, you would be amazed if I said there was a local company in Devon called Westaway Sausages, and some of your listeners may actually have seen their products in our own supermarkets locally. And they started exporting to China. They now have a manufacturing plant in China because there is such a demand for their sausages. So what we have to remember is, one, there's a huge expat community. And of course, every year in the city, there is somewhere in the region of 3,000 Chinese students, all of whom experience city life, our culture, our food, and our etiquette while they're here. And
do they?
They
because
do.
I thought they mostly ate in those noodle bars.
Well, they do, because that responds to them and that reminds them of home. But they do go and try all the other products. And when they go back home to China, they still want to be able to find those products in China in the same way as when we've all been on holiday to Spain and Mexico and Italy and everywhere. We want to find all of that food on our doorstep when we come home.
Now, I know the university is actually planning to bring even more students from China, aren't they? What are the quantities? How many? They're saying that they, over the next 2 years, want another 6,000 students at the university. And I imagine quite a lot of those will be Chinese.
Well, a lot of them will be international. The challenge for the university in terms of growing numbers to that extent, as happens across the board, is always to ensure that you're not dominated by any one nationality, because the Chinese students come here to have a more international and European and British flavour. And so the last thing they want is to find themselves in a studio or a class or a lecture with just more Chinese students, because they could have that experience actually in China without the expense of coming to the UK. So they do want that broader experience. And I think Bristol as a city is very global, it's very international, it has a very broad focus, and therefore it is very attractive. But there are challenges in growing student numbers, you know, to that extent, to make sure that there is that balance and that complementarity.
What about some of the knotty issues to do with Hong Kong? Obviously, Guangzhou is very close to Hong Kong. It's not been a very comfortable separation. I mean, in fact, it's from many Hong Kong people's point of view, they feel swallowed up by China, a much bigger country which doesn't necessarily share some of their values. I mean, in fact, they have a protest culture in Hong Kong which the Chinese government don't like.
Well, that's right. I mean, Hong Kong, obviously, looking back, British rule, British ways, and all of that open democracy and people being able to have a voice, which is quite different to the rest of mainland China. But it is one country, two systems currently. And therefore, the people in Hong Kong can still have their say in a slightly different way to the people in mainland China. And they are, you know, learning to live and integrate together.
Now, look,
but it will always be different.
Well, they're learning to, some of them, by going to jail, aren't they? I mean, we've had, for example, people literally for saying that they think that there should be democratic leader elected in Hong Kong, that can land you in jail. And there's also these laws which many Hong Kong people have complained about. I mean, I think people across the world are questioning these laws. But things like by laughing during the national anthem, criticising the leader, President Xi. I mean, I think we'd be very, very lost in Britain if we couldn't criticise our leaders here. And yet that's not, you're not supposed to be openly critical of the leadership in China. That's a very different culture. I just wonder what you think is, whether you think that Hong Kong can continue to have that freedom of expression under that sort of circumstance.
I think the relationship will continue to evolve and it will change. And there is a saying in China that the Chinese are very open and very welcoming to new ideas, and they go around the world exploring opportunities and learning from everyone else. And they're also very good at, you know, sharing their own expertise. But they will always take what happens everywhere else and bundled it up when they go back to China, and then come up with what they say is the China way, a way that will fit in with their own culture, their own process, their own political systems, and taking account of the history and where they're striving to go in the future. And that is the China way. They will also be very understanding of the rest of the world. So they will never criticise anybody else for doing anything, because in return, they don't expect to be criticised for what they are doing.
Well, we actually started to see a little bit of that with this whole spat with the Americans over Huawei. And, you know, they're saying, effectively, the Americans are saying that, oh, well, the Chinese are using this high-tech equipment to spy on people. Well, I wonder whether the Americans don't use some of their high-tech equipment to spy on people too, and we're not supposed to even think that. But look, coming back to the to this business of President Xi, isn't he sort of a bit too much of a revered figure? Don't you think it's actually quite healthy to have criticism of whoever your political leaders are?
I think in the Western world, that is definitely the way. In China, it is not the way. The people and good friends and colleagues that I have, then they will not do that because it is against their culture, because they just don't accept that that's what you do. The majority of the people that I talk to in China do revere President Xi. They think that he is doing a fantastic job, that he has done a lot in terms of helping Joe Public, if you
isn't it a bit of a sort of almost like a replacement for religion? I mean, the Chinese don't actually look so happily or positively on religious faith, whereas we, at least we say we do in this part of the world. The idea that you've got to revere somebody who's your leader, well, it's okay if everything's going right, but what if it's not?
Well, that's right. And as long, you know, as when the people do believe that it is going right and it does seem to be going in the right direction as far as they're concerned, because, you know, despite what we hear in the West and despite what we think about the Chinese economy, it is still growing at a rate far beyond any Western country.
The funny thing
and
is about China,
the
is,
people are still benefiting from that.
The funny thing about China is it's almost like they've outbid the Americans as capitalists. Now, they're supposed to be a communist country, but they've actually been more successful capitalists than anyone in the West.
That's right, because they are able to focus attention. They're able to have an actual direction. They have a 5-year plan. They follow it. It benefits the country and it benefits individuals all the time. They're working to improve terms and conditions for everyone, to bring more people out of poverty. And they're actually achieving it probably more successfully than we are in the West.
Well, what about Beijing? It's all smoggy and horrid. I once got offered a job in Beijing. I took one look at the atmosphere and I thought I couldn't work in a city like that.
No, it is pretty bad at times.
I mean, you really have to wear a gas mask or something.
And the pollution. But, you know, all the new cities and towns that they are building in China, and they are building at a phenomenal rate, they're all smart cities, all fully integrated with work, life, leisure, accommodation, and all green. So everything they're building, they are building in the right way to ensure that the future will be better. But in doing that, then they also have to work back through all the old power stations in order to improve them. Because as soon as the power stations are switched off for holidays and all the industry stops, then all that fog and the pollution disappears.
Well, let's hope so. Also, there was a fascinating film by the Australian journalist John Pilger a few years ago, shown, I think it was like Tuesday night late on ITV, called The Coming War with China. Now, some people call him alarmist, but he's said that the United States has been making moves around the Pacific that are actually threatening China. What do the Chinese make of these moves?
I have no idea, because it's not a topic that's ever discussed.
But, okay, so have you not seen the film?
And I haven't seen the film.
Well, I would suggest you have a watch of it, because there's still tension. I mean, I think it's the South China Sea. There's often talk about tension there. But Pilger goes into a much deeper, he's looking at it over a very long period. Even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he's found people to interview who say that they were actually ordered to fire nukes at China, but they refused to, saying, well, actually, China's not involved in this confrontation with the Russians and the Soviet Union, so we're not going to fire this missile we've been told to fire. But anyway, I mean, this South China Sea conflict, this potentially, I mean, I just wonder who you think is really responsible for it.
I think I have an open mind. I'm not quite sure who is responsible for it. And I think with any situation like that, it's probably all parties, both parties, whoever, that have to take some responsibility.
But it wouldn't be the only part of the world that the Americans are sort of provoking people, would it?
No. Well, yes.
What about, looking at the culture side of things? Mm. Do you think the Chinese have got much culture to offer?
They've got a fantastic heritage and culture, and it's...
I tend to think of sort of plays with jingling of bells and things like
right.
that.
That's right. The Chinese opera is really fantastic, actually, if you see it live. And there is a group that tours the UK and appears in Cheltenham every year, and they're bringing that culture and
Give us an idea of the sorts of stories they tell in these plays, then, in the opera.
It's all about history and love and, relationships and people.
I visited Hong Kong a few years ago and I was incredibly impressed by the museums there, particularly their absolutely honest telling of history. Things like the Opium Wars, this kind of thing, the British Empire's interference in China, tricking of the Chinese in all sorts of ways and really underhand fashion. Do you think the Chinese take their history seriously, or are they more livers of the moment?
Oh, now that's... I do think they take their history seriously. And as you say, they have some fantastic museums, they have some fantastic monuments and temples, and, you have the Forbidden City and places like that where, they have preserved the history in stone. But they did go through a period, obviously, in that great period of development and very rapid development, where a lot of that sort of ancient history was being wiped out. But they've now, like we all did in the West, woken up to the fact that they do need to retain that, because that is a moment in time in terms of capturing how life was and what China was like at that time, and also being able to share it with everyone else across the world. And all the students and everyone who comes here, they're really keen to share that sort of culture, from their tea ceremonies, from their lovely food, from all the martial arts clubs now that are burgeoning across the city, as well as the Chinese dancing. We haven't... There may be a Chinese opera club at the university, but I'm not sure about that one. But certainly the performance that students put on for Chinese New Year encompasses the whole gamut of the Chinese cultural spectrum.
How have you got on learning the Chinese language?
I failed miserably, I'm afraid.
Can you give us a couple of phrases?
Well, the one that I always sticks in my mind is "Wo ai Chung Kwa," which is "I love China." So that's a wonderful point, isn't it?
What about places? Have you visited China much?
I have. I've been going to China since the mid-80s. I first went to Hong Kong in 85 and to mainland China in 1989.
So give us a couple of recommended spots to visit. And why is it that, you tell us each one, maybe just a couple, but each one, what was so special about that for you?
So special about it was, on my very first visit, I went to Beijing and did all of that sightseeing stuff about the Forbidden City, the Ming tombs, the Great Wall of China. And so for me, it was like opening up the history book that I'd studied in school, but seeing it there for my very own eyes. So it is absolutely brilliant. And then to Hangzhou, where the beautiful lakes are with all those lovely curved bridges going over them, which the Chinese refer to heaven on earth. And it is so idyllic. I can see how, you know, that sort of captures the heart. And Shanghai, which is so international and cosmopolitan and a real sort of hit, mixed to the senses of East meets West because of its history. When you arrive at the Bund and you see these very tall, very solid, you could be in the City of London, and then right behind it you have the most magnificent Chinese market that there ever was. So it's that East meets West, and it's like going from Hong Kong into Guangdong province. Again, you still have that flavour, you have the smells and the sense of the people. And the thing that sticks in my mind, as I say, is just seeing in 1989 all those people in their sort of Mao suits with their straw hats, carrying their buckets of water over their shoulders, and donkeys and carts, and just thousands of people just milling the streets. And that was in 1989. There was hardly a car. And now, if you go to Beijing, there are, what, 4, 5, 6, 7 ring roads going around Beijing, and everyone is referred to as the biggest parking lot in the land. So that's the rate of progress and the growth in the economy and, if you like, affluence of people. It's not all necessarily for the good when you move from people to cars blocking those roads.
Well, it's almost a rural society to an industrial society. You know, it's just in the face of a few years up since the Chinese Revolution was only around the time of the Second World War. So anyone listening is interested in, you know, getting involved in Chinese cultural events and things like that in the city, are there opportunities?
There are always opportunities, yes. And they're signposted through our website, which is www.chinabureau.co.uk. So you can always find information there about
what's
happening.
Just give us an idea of some up-and-coming events. What
the
sort
up-and-coming,
of
we have a business powwow networking event that's happening on the 20th of June.
So this is for those that want to sell their stuff in China.
Or learn from others who are engaging with China. So they might be thinking about entering the market, new to the market, and want to just share experiences and pick up some tips. And or they might just want to meet other China enthusiasts. There are a lot of people who return to the city who have spent some time in China, and they just want to engage with an organisation and people where they can share their stories and talk about their experiences. So whether you're interested in trade, in business, in import-export, education, or just sharing some culture, then the Powwow series events, we have a whole range of different topics. But the next one is the 20th of June from 6 till 8:30, and it's going to be held at Desk Lodge 2, which is next to the Doubletree Hilton Hotel by St. Mary Redcliffe on Redcliffe Way.
Sounds like lots of for people to do, whether it's just cultural interest or business interests, from the Bristol and West of England. China Bureau, Diane Frankham, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Now a couple of songs from Martian, that is Martin Cosgrave, whose funeral took place in London this week, one of the co-founders of Dialect with me back in 2001. Mechanopologist, and after that, Showers, Good. Thank you.
the news now. The shipping forecast issued by the Met Office at 0505 today, Saturday the 27th of September. The general synopsis at 0100, low Norway 1005, expected Baltic 1001 by 0100 tomorrow. New low expected Dover 1015 by same time. Low southwest Fitzroy 1018, moving southeast and losing its identity.
dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Stephen Landrigan. I'm an American. I lived in Kabul from 2004 to 2010, and much of that time was at the Kala and Noborja in Kartipar 1. It is an old fortified house that had been built in the 1880s. And it had fallen into some disrepair. Myself and some other foreigners had, in exchange for using some of the rooms, had put those rooms back to shape. And Rory arrived, I believe, in May of 2006 and took up residence there as well.
So when did you first meet this conservative leadership hopeful Rory Stewart then?
I'm not sure that I can remember exactly. Before he came to live with us, he was around Kabul, and I saw him in a few restaurants. I'm sure I was introduced to him by somebody. He was there a good bit before he actually set up his organization at our place.
What was he doing there?
Well, my understanding is that he had been entrusted by the Prince's Trust or whomever to set up a school for handicrafts in Kabul. What had happened was Hamid Karzai had come to London, had a dinner with Prince Charles, where I think it was Prince Bandar and a Lebanese banker and somebody else was there. They ginned up £1.5 million, something like that, and decided, yes, let's go ahead. President Karzai had seen the one in the East End of London, the handicraft school, and thought we really need something like that in Afghanistan. Rory was at the table because he had then finished his walk through part of Afghanistan and written a book about it. And somehow or other, the conversation led to his being engaged to run that project.
And what were you doing there, Stephen?
I wasn't at that meeting with Prince Charles, but I was
in Kabul.
Yeah, I was in Kabul as an aid worker. I was working in those days on an education program that was for kids, teenagers who had never had a day in school and who were too old to go into the regular school system. We were doing what we called accelerated education to bring them up to speed and get them through the first six grades in a year, two and a half years about.
This Turquoise Mountain Foundation that Rory set up, there's a lot of money that went through it. It did a lot of things. What was the object of it? When did you first come across this?
I would say, first of all, let me say that I'm a great supporter of Turquoise Mountain Foundation. And although Rory managed it by whim and a lot of money that he controlled was used foolishly, many of the people who were attracted to work at Turquoise Mountain did very, very good work. And they've left a good legacy, so I'm not for one second against Turquoise Mountain.
Could you just give us an idea of what Turquoise Mountain actually was? What was it based on? What is a turquoise mountain? Why was it called that?
Turquoise Mountain is some place in central Afghanistan that Rory said that he walked by in his walk between Herat and Kabul. Nobody else seems to know much about it. I don't know anything about it, but that doesn't mean anything. It might well be there. Why he picked that, we don't know. But what they did, they originally had three programs. One was to teach calligraphy, one was to teach wood carving, and one was to revitalize a pottery business a pottery industry, really, that had been going on in a village about a half hour north of Kabul called Istilif. The calligraphy went pretty well. A lot of kids came in. They had a great time doing it. I'm not sure what came of it. The woodworking was sort of the big money maker for Turquoise Mountain in its first years. And then the pottery never really got off the ground. They had a number of people sent to run it who really didn't know anything for a couple of years. And then finally they brought out a professional potter who was a Canadian citizen, though born in Holland. And then it made some sense. The one of the problems that happens in staffing the organization, Rory lured away people from the Foundation for Culture and Civil Society and from the UN's Habitat group, which I think that was where the calligraphy people came from. It was a cultural development thing. And then he also took all of the wood carvers from a Nuristani-style wood workshop that was run by Mrs. Ashraf Ghani, wife of the current president. And basically, he acid-stripped these organizations to bring them to create Turquoise Mountain. He had an article in one of the British papers some years ago saying how he had done all this, created a whole institute in a case of a month, but he didn't mention that it was all done by taking resources from other organizations, which actually never recovered.
What about this place where you and he were living? It sounds quite exciting, a kind of fort built originally in 1880. Can you tell us something about the history and what Rory did there?
Yeah, well, the quick history is that when it was built, it was out in the country. Kabul City was the Bala Hisar, which was about 4 or 5 miles away. This was out a place where it was good hunting. There was wetlands nearby. And the king at the time, Abdurrahman, built himself a palace at the top of a hill. And this where the Kali Noborja was built down below it, and his wazir lived there.
Okay, so how old is the place?
1880. About 1880 is what architectural historians generally accept.
And it was a kind of quadrangle with various people, aid workers, etc., living there. What did Rory do? Because I understand he kind of built on it. She's a bit peculiar since he's renting the property. He then also spent money improving the place. What did he do?
Well, everybody did a certain amount of that. We all put in our own lighting and in some cases water and so on like that. You had to do it. This place was a mud brick fort, 2 or 3 stories high and very, very elegant and very much of another age, but not a place for modern living. So, but what Rory did was he then built like a triumphal arch attached to the front of the main entrance into the courtyard. He built a gatehouse right out of Disney at the edge of the property that everybody had to come through. He built a kiln for his pottery work, so it was never really used in a great amount because most of the pottery was done, as I say, a half hour north. And then there was a cement brick house on the property that belonged to a relative of the woman who claimed to own the fort. And so without contacting those people, he doubled the size of the house, clad it in mud bricks, and made it look very, very old. It's actually quite nice. I mean, I have to say one thing about Turquoise Mountain. They did a good job. And then when the family found out what was happening to their house, they raised a noise, and I think Rory paid them quite a bit. So what I'm saying, the overall picture is Rory spent a lot of money, donor money, on aggrandizing his position by building a viceroy-style mansion in Kabul, which was perfect for the photo ops, which was good because every glossy magazine in Britain seemed to be coming through there on a regular basis to photograph Rory in situ.
Now, there's also rumours about actually native Afghans being evicted by him. Is there any truth to that?
That's not rumours. It actually happened. Be careful how you phrase it. Rory does everything through third parties. Rory did not go up to these people and say, you have to leave. But he engineered a situation where other people went and did that. And Rory ultimately was the beneficiary. In both cases, these were very impoverished Hazara Afghan families who lived just adjacent to our main courtyard. Rory wanted their territory because as his staff increased, he needed more place to put people. In fact, one time we were walking in front of the rooms I had, we're up on the second level overlooking one of these families, and he says, how do we know for sure that Mabuba owns this? Mabuba is the widow of the man who had owned the place. And I said, well, you know, you need to find out. But Rory, he said, I must have that land. But there were people down there. They were tending their cow. They were drawing water from the well, which took 42 pulls on the rope. It was a family, and Rory didn't see them. He wanted that land, and that's all there was to it.
Well, it sounds like a kind of sense of entitlement, almost a kind of throwback to Victorian colonial days.
You put your finger right on it. Rory's sense of entitlement is more than anybody had ever met. Now, you know, I'm an American. I understand that there are people in England who maybe move in circles. That's how they do it. I don't know that, but I sense it. But Rory's sense of entitlement was second to none, and it was very, very evident in that. And in almost everything else he did, there was no consequences to what he said or did because it was Rory. He could do what he wanted.
What about his legacy now, do you think, in Kabul?
Well, Turquoise Mountain is still there and they're still doing projects. And they recently got money from the U.S. Agency for International Development. I think they have a track record. I think they're honest. The one thing about Turquoise Mountain is that their overhead in those days was only 7%, whereas most of the American contractors that took money from donors were charging 38-39%. So as I say, Turquoise Mountain on its own is really not a bad thing. It was just Rory's ways that really were the problem.
But I mean, the people I would imagine that he's interacted with over the years there, Stephen, I haven't necessarily forgotten him, particularly when we're talking about people having been evicted from their homes, native people.
No, I don't suspect they have, but I can't tell you that I've been in touch with them because I haven't. When I left Kabul in 2010, I saw them a couple of times after that. I went back and I did seek them out once, living where they were forced to go, which was in sharing a small house with another family. They had to give up their cow, which was their only source of cash flow, $4 a day. But for an Afghan, that's a lot. More importantly, where we lived at the fort, we were close to a vegetable market, so they could go in the evening and get the old vegetables that had fallen off of wagons and been crushed and things, bring them, feed them to the cow. So the cow had a very good diet, gave very, very good milk. It made the best yogurt I've ever had. But more importantly, once they left the fort and no longer had this income, then the family was no longer able to send their daughters to school. They had 5 daughters and 5 sons. And this family was very determined, particularly the mother, that all of her daughters would get full education in high school and then go on to college, university. They got pushed out about 45 minutes to an hour away, a place where there was no schools. And so Rory essentially, through his actions, truncated any chance that these girls would ever have any opportunity in life. Very ironic for a man who was running a charity, supposed to be helping Afghans.
How would you describe his character as someone that was with him? And if you can just tell us roughly what years you were living next door.
I was in the fort from about 2005 to 2008. Rory came in I think it was May of 2006. I think that was it. And then I left. He was still there when I left. So we overlapped about 2.5 years.
And what's your memory of him as a person?
I thought of him as a cross between Peter Pan and Uriah Heep. This is a man who was flitting around, feeling very self-important at all times, always engaged in self-mythologizing, but a man who was not, would not listen. He loved an audience, but he was not a listener. And he was always right, and he was always grand, and just the kind of person you run away from.
I mean, this is a very important time for Afghanistan. I would have thought there would have been some sort of press coverage of Rory, his activities there. Was there any? Was there any interest?
Oh, what? Every week he had somebody coming out. He obviously had a PR firm. Somebody has suggested that it's Bell Pottinger, the discredited firm. I don't know that. Yes, there was, you name it, particularly the glossy magazines, not just British, it was the American. Smithsonian was out. Time got him to write some pieces, but Vanity Fair, I don't know if it was, I shouldn't say that, I don't know that, but several others. They do dozens of them. What was most amazing about it, Tony, was that every article seemed to follow the same format. It was almost as if somebody had given the writers, points. These need to be covered. I don't know if that happened, but that you couldn't read these, many, many dozens of articles without wondering who's behind this. It was even true, not just the glossies. I mean, there was some of the British newspapers. I don't want to bother mentioning names, but there was some of the articles that we read followed just right along the line. And the worst thing was every single one of them completely promoted Rory's bio as he would print it in the front of the books that he published. But it's bogus. And nobody checked it. And
What was bogus about his biography?
Well, I mean, this is nothing I have personal connection. I personally have not investigated it, but Ian Parker of The New Yorker did so in 2015 and found that Rory's claim to have been part of the Black Watch Regiment was apparently some summer program for young people. That his much vaunted time as a tutor to the princes Harry and William was only for 2 weeks one summer. I'm not sure if Ian Parker did this, but a man named Craig Murray, who was once British ambassador to neighboring Uzbekistan, claimed that Rory was MI6. I don't know that myself. And I'm trying to think what's the other one. Anyway, it was that kind of thing. It was always Rory promoting himself, but nobody ever checked him. Nobody checked the facts. Nobody asked any hard questions of Rory. That drove me crazy.
Okay. Do you think he'd make a good prime minister?
Well, if Britain wants to have the Trump experience, they should vote for him. But this is a man who is not able to speak the truth. He's about promoting his image, his ambitions. He's not completely stupid. I'm sure he'll do some things right. But would I vote for him? No. I'm not in one party or the other in terms of British politics, but I would not want a man quite so dishonest at the top of my country.
He's also denied ever being involved in MI6, but some have said that actually if you are involved in MI6, that's what you have to say.
That may well be. I don't have a clue. I don't know anything about MI6.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you don't have to deny it. You know, you can just leave it in a way that creates the perfect mystique, doesn't it? If you neither confirm nor deny.
Rory was pretty good at that and other things. If Rory didn't want to discuss something, he would turn around and walk away. And that happened to me a couple of times and happened to other people.
So. What sorts of subjects? Yes. Can I ask what sort of subjects he'd do that?
I'd be hard-pressed to remember all of them, but I remember there was one that was told to me by a man from Nepal. Rory had talked about having walked across Asia and part of Nepal, and the Nepali gentleman said he'd love to know more about the route that Rory took because it was virtually impossible for a person to have walked across it. And this was at the Asia Foundation at a dinner. reception, and Rory didn't answer. He just turned around and walked away. That's our Rory. So, you know, never apologize, never explain.
Okay, Stephen, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, all the best.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Suggest interviewees, subscribe to our email list, and listen the week before broadcast if you like at our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Diane Frankham from Bristol and West of England China Bureau, and the former Washington Post journalist and aid worker, Stephen Landrigan. Also to studio engineers, Dave Pasenko and Joss Chivers. Dialects are Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk, and they even have an old-fashioned telephone, 0117 909 6897. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us, or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the national volunteering website do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8pm. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now. Down, 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 down
You.